Pope is the thing with feathers.
Pope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis.
Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm Daryl Ellis, and I am not your host.
Hi, Daryl.
Hey. No worries. Courtney is here with me, though.
Daryl is launching this particular episode of the podcast because he wanted to ask me some questions. So why not do that in front of all of you?
For sure. Because, Courtney, you have a book coming out.
I do. I have a book coming out on April 9th. It's called Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. So we're right on that cusp of the book launch and things are getting exciting around here.
Yeah. You want to say anything more about your book, where it came from?
So the book really is kind of the story of my own birding journey. I've shared often on the podcast, I'm a fairly new birder. I've really only been doing this since 2020. I'm not an expert. I'm a birding enthusiast. But this book is the story of walking through a really deep season of grief in my life, grief from the pandemic. I think we were all grieving all of the changes in our life, all of the pain and the difficulty, many folks with serious health challenges going on. But then also my beloved grandfather died, and he was part of the heritage in my family that was really, really just profoundly connected to the outdoors. He was an ice fisherman in northern Wisconsin. He really did love animals more than people. And he would always be sitting by his big picture window saying, look at the birds, look what's out there. So in his death and in my own birding practice, I really had to press deeply into my faith. And I found that a lot of my spiritual practices, prayer and fasting and reading of scripture, were not life-giving to me in the same way they always had been, but birding was. Birding became a new way to pray. Birding became a new way to connect with the Lord. And that just gave me such a profound hope. So I wrote this story. It's not heavily memoir. My editor calls the memoir section the strings section of the orchestra. It's a lot about birds and about the way God meets us through natural theology in the natural world, and in these soulful spiritual practices that feel much less like doing for God and much more like letting God meet us right where we are.
Yeah, I love that description of the memoir section. And I love how you connected to your grandpa, both in his life and his death. I think the connection between your grandpa and you is one of the most fascinating parts of the books, because he was not a man of many words, and you are a woman of many words. And yet there was a deep connection and resonance between what the two of you longed for and the way that you lived in the world and what you noticed and what brought you joy.
I will never forget the connection the two of you had, because you were, in ways that not many people are, you were comfortable with silence. And so he liked you right away. And you guys had a special bond as well.
We had an unspoken appreciation that this better matter or I don't have time for it.
Oh, God bless.
I think he loved me for that reason, but he also didn't like me a little bit because I married you.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a little bit bothered by that.
But I think there was a sense of happy resignation that, well, if Courtney does have to get married, Daryl's kind of okay.
If she does have to go down this path, at least there's a decent human at the other end of it.
Exactly. So take us back to your book. What are your hopes for its release? And remind us again when it gets released.
So yeah, the book comes out April 9th with IVP, InterVarsity Press. And my hopes for it are that folks who are in a season of grief, who are longing for hope, would find themselves in these pages. I think birding is kind of a universal opportunity to connect with some deeper things. And I like to say that birds are the great unifier. You may not love birds, but you probably don't hate them. And they bring people together across all sorts of differences in life. And so my hope is that this book would be a great encouragement to people who maybe feel stuck in their spiritual practice, who maybe have never connected with God on a deep level before, or who are feeling so stuck in their grief, they're not sure how to move forward, that this is a story of sorrow, but underneath all of that, it is a story of profound love that found me, and I think that is searching for all of us.
Can you take us a little bit into how you organize the chapters. You organize them very interestingly around individual birds and connect them to the nuance and things that are really interesting about each bird and what it means to notice those things and what we can kind of intuit about what kind of creator God is, that he made a world where that God made this particular bird and God made birds in general. I think connecting with God through nature has become such a wellspring of life for both of us that I'm still surprised when I talk to other Christians about there's some suspicion of connecting with God through the natural, lots of suspicion actually, that we can only connect with God through the Bible and through Jesus, which of course still stands. Since God created the world and God came through Jesus, there it's actually like one work of God, and we can connect with God with both in both the natural world and through Jesus. But you link, if there's the memoir thread, there's also the thread of each chapter having a particular bird lens. Take us through how you came up with that and how it kind of shapes the book.
Every chapter is centered on a big concept like death or love or beauty. And that concept is connected to a particular bird or species of bird. So doves.
Death.
Death is connected to vultures. Partnership is connected to wrens, I believe.
Yes.
And all of these different interplays, I'm able to do a deep dive into particular kinds of birds and also some of the ways those birds illustrate these deeper things in our lives and in our faith and in our experiences of how we move about the world. So death and vultures is really obvious. You know, that's a very obvious connection. But what's the connection for sparrows? What's the connection for finches? And how does this deep dive into what the birds themselves have to teach us more about ourselves, more about God, more about healthy ways of being in the world? This book was a labor of love for me, but it also almost wrote itself. Those connections just started to become so clear as I studied pelicans and what they were like and what they do and how they move and the unique ways that God has created them. So the organization flows through the natural story of hearing the news about my grandfather that he'd fallen ill, taking a trip to Wisconsin, and then his death and his funeral, and the birds guide us all along the way. And I, like I said, I'm not an expert. I am an enthusiast, but I learned so much in researching for this book that I didn't know before. And that's one of the things I love about birding. It really is a bottomless bowl of knowledge and delight. You think you know everything about birds? You don't know everything about birds. There's always something new to learn, some new discovery. And for me, that is one of the deep joys about both writing this book and about birding in general.
It is one of my favorite parts of the book, the way that by following your imagination in connection with these birds, and you help make the poetic and metaphorical link to your story and to life in general, it's a really great practice in what it looks like to recover and retrieve that creativity and that imagination and connecting the natural world to our lives as well. How do you feel about the launch?
Before I was a writer, I thought when your book comes into the world, it's just pure joy, pure excitement. And there is a lot of that. There's a lot of joy. There's a lot of excitement. But also, it kind of feels like you're being asked to stand naked before the world. And, you know, there's that scene in an early season of Grey's Anatomy where Meredith Grey says, pick me, choose me, love me. And I always think about that scene when I'm launching a book, because it is a very vulnerable thing, especially for books that have a memoir element, as mine often do, to say, hey, I'm putting this out in the world. I think it's pretty good, but tell me what you think about it. So what I've learned, I think, in launching previous books is to just enjoy it, to let it wash over me, but also to remember that there are still other things going on. There's still more work to be done. So my hope is that on the day it comes out, April 9th, I'm flying to Michigan to be part of a writer's conference, that I'd be able to get out birding a little bit and just let those feelings go and let the joy come where it will and let the book do how it does. I've done all that I can, and just kind of weather the storm of all of the big feelings that come on the day of a launch.
Your grandpa would be really happy that you're going to be in the Midwest on the day that it comes out.
And it also, it comes out a week before the anniversary of his death, which I had nothing to do with. The publisher sets that date, but there is something kind of soulful about releasing a book that essentially is a love letter to someone who is very dear to me on the, almost on the eve of the anniversary of his death. And now I'm tearing up. I blame you for this.
It's a heart of love and grief for you. It was a labor of that love and grief for sure. Speaking of, will you read an excerpt for us from the book?
I would love to. I got the publisher's permission to read the first chapter in its entirety. So without further ado, chapter one, From Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. Chapter one, Looking Up, Birding. You could do worse than to spend your days staring at blue jays. Julie Zicifus. When I first began birding, my husband Daryl regarded the entire enterprise with a kind of perplexed, gentle bewilderment. In our 14 years of marriage and preceding 5 years of friendship that blossomed into dating, I'd never once mentioned birds. I never really even noticed them. Then, near the end of my 30s, as sudden and unexpected as a flash of lightning on a cloudless night, the birding began. I imagined this could be annoying. We'd be in the middle of a conversation, laying out ministry strategy or parenting logistics, sitting together with our coffee in the backyard, and I'd look up and gasp. What? Oh my gosh, Daryl, it's a kinglet, ruby-crowned, I think. Just hold that thought. I'm going to get my field guide. He bore with the hiking and the bird identification apps, the growing stack of birding books, and all the feeders I hung in the backyard. He bought me binoculars for Christmas and put our three kids to bed by himself night after night during the annual spring migrations with nary a complaint. Still, I suspect a small part of him thought I might be using the hobby as a convenient escape from the daily grind of domestic life. Then came a month of wildfires, the air near our Southern California home too choked with smoke for easy breathing, much less hikes into the hills. Our backyard birds sheltered, their songs clipped and short, their behavior agitated. My own mood darkened with the ominous orange sky that turned our neighborhood Martian, the fine ash that blanketed our cars. We plodded on together, air purifiers running on high in our bedrooms, outdoor activities canceled or moved inside. We did okay, Daryl and the kids and me, but I couldn't shake the feeling that I was less than whole. I see now that you need your birds, Daryl told me. I don't understand why, but I see that you do. I don't always understand why either. I never needed birds before, but now I do. Birding is a switch that flips. Amateurs and ornithologists alike can point to a particular bird that turned the light on for them. We call it a spark bird, the bird that changes everything forever. It may not end up being a person's favorite bird, or even a very noteworthy or beautiful or rare one, but it is a watershed. There is a before and an after, and nothing is ever the same again. You have a Phoebe, my friend Michelle gestured to our backyard string lights where a small black and white songbird perched, flicking its tail up and down. I studied the bird for a few moments, the tuft of black feathers atop its head, its bright black eyes and tiny black beak, its white front and quick, jerky movements. I didn't yet know the words for most of what I was seeing, that the tuft of feathers was a crest, the bird itself a type of flycatcher. I didn't know the importance of precision when describing a bird. The Phoebe didn't have a white front, it had a white belly. I didn't know it was called a black Phoebe, distinguishable in color and size from the Eastern and Say's varieties. What I did know in those very first moments was that this little bird had unexpectedly captivated me. For a moment, the volume turned down on my shouting to-do list and clamoring young children and creaky house projects and pinging work emails, and it was just me and this bird. A moment in time, a breath, delight. In that moment, I looked up. Birds are invisible to us until they aren't. Or perhaps they aren't invisible, not exactly. They are simply a background to the rest of life, the more immediate, louder bits. Perhaps we remember the gull that stole our cookie or the swans that paddled across a lake we frequented as children. Maybe we watched pigeons from our apartment window or fed leftover lunch crumbs to sparrows on our school playground. But mostly birds were not really a thing. And then one day, out of nowhere, the spark. Perhaps you have a spark bird of your own, a great egret or a black rail or indigo bunting, a tall spindly flamingo or a tiny buzzy hummingbird. maybe you're contemplating putting this book down because you were expecting to read about hope and grief, and here I am yammering on about birds, which is not what you signed up for. But here's the thing. Illumination is inscribed on every page of creation. Chanting aloft in the pine tops, wrote the poet Robert Service, the wind has a lesson to teach. In his first letter to the Thessalonians, Paul writes that we do not grieve like those who have no hope, for we believe Jesus died and rose again. These holy reminders come to us through Scripture, but that is not their only place of speech. The natural world pulses with the heartbeat of God, and birds are a unique avenue into this understanding. Look at the birds, Jesus tells the crowds up on the mountainside, and one by one the people look up, and Jesus begins to show each soul its dignity and value and worth. In the book of Exodus, Moses is hard at work herding his father-in-law Jethro's sheep. Anyone who has worked for an in-law knows that the pressure is on to do the job well. As Moses and his sheep meander through the wilderness, Moses' eyes are tuned, on the lookout for pitfalls and predators. He's hoping to spot a lush patch of grass or two when his attention is diverted by a strange sight. There, over in the chaparral, is a bush aflame. Small fires are not unusual in this parched land of heat and scrub, but Moses is drawn closer by a realization. This bush is burning, yet it is not consumed. The fire does not spread, nor does it go out. It burns and burns and burns. Take off your shoes, comes a voice, for the ground upon which you stand is holy. There is a before and an after. There is a spark and a burning. In this moment, Moses is set upon a path from which he will never return, a journey that will have its end decades beyond and hundreds of miles away from this small patch of holy ground. Rare are the moments in our lives where we can point to a before and an after. There are graduations and marriages and births, accidents and illnesses and deaths, but mostly there are long strings of ordinary days, one after the other after the other. We wake and sleep, we eat and work, we play and rest. Everything is pretty much the same, until it isn't. After the burning bush, Moses will face months of wrangling with the great Pharaoh of Egypt. There will be a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire and a miraculous crossing of the Red Sea. This will be followed by decades of wandering in the wilderness. A few transcendent moments will give way to 40 years of slogging obedience. Yet God will plant reminders of his presence along this arduous journey. Bread from heaven, water from a stone, quail to nourish the body. God will speak to Moses. God will appear to him. God will continue to guide. Even in the slog, there is hope. Many years before Moses, God pulled Abraham from his tents in the dead of night and called him to the edge of his camp. Look up, God told Abraham, look at the stars. In the Gospels, Jesus sees the fear and anxiety of the crowds and points them heavenward too. Look at the birds, says Jesus, are you not worth more than many sparrows? Every year or so, Daryl and the kids and I take a whale watching tour from a marina near our home. Inevitably, a tourist or two will get seasick, even in calm waters. Then the captain will tell them to keep their eyes on the horizon. It's turned into a spiritual metaphor for me. The boat will go up and down, up and down, up and down our whole life long. But if we keep our eyes up, we can catch a glimpse of salvation. I'm not a professional birder, or even an impressive amateur one. I feel the need to mention this at the outset because I'm no ornithologist or biologist or expert in the ways of the avian world. This will not be a field guide to the birds of Southern California, or an extensive exploration of ecology, or even a big year type chronicle of the species I've encountered. At least one chapter will describe a bird I've never even seen in person. My only qualification for the birdy parts of this book are a deep fascination with all things avian and an even deeper love. I love birds. Why? Because birds are amazing. Their biodiversity alone astonishes. There are hummingbirds that can perch on a strand of hair, and pigeons the size of turkeys, and cassowaries that could kill an adult man with a kick. Birds come in every color imaginable, black and white, pink and blue, iridescent greens and purples, translucent silver, spotted red. There are birds that can hear sound where we only recognize silence, and birds whose songs are so complex they cannot be parsed by the human ear. There are birds that thrive in temperatures that would quickly freeze or practically cook a human. There are birds that clean up the dead. Some birds can mimic human voices, others sing hundreds of unique songs. Exquisitely beautiful birds give image to the Platonic ideal of perfection, while others look doodled by toddlers. Who thought to place the eye of a Wilson's snipe there? There are birds with 12-foot wingspans and at least one species without wings at all. Though, to be fair, that one has been extinct for over 500 years. Poor Moa. While the world's loudest bird can match the decibel level of a jet engine, the quietest one flies so softly its wing beats are imperceptible to all but our most sophisticated microphones. Even the names of birds are a delight. Fairy wren, elf owl, diabolical nightjar, bananaquit, honey creeper, handsome fruit eater, cinnamon teal, predicted ant wren, spectacled tyrant. Their collectives get even better. It's a drumming of grouse, a kettle of hawks, a lamentation of swans, a gatling of woodpeckers. Penguins come in huddles. Ravens, conspiracies. Swallows, a gulp, of course. If you get tired of a squabble of gulls, you may be ready for a charm of finches. If a scream of swifts isn't your thing, perhaps I could interest you in a scold of jays instead. Beyond the etymological pleasures, much of the culture itself around birding is a joy. I love the gentle nerdiness of so many birding people. Their pocket-covered pants, their silly hats, their sturdy shoes, their nicknamed binoculars. These are bins for those of you who are uninitiated. I love the intense competitive birders and the whispering introverts. I love the casual birders and the obsessives too. I love birding's code of ethics and ecotourism, its whimsy and wonder, its bird of the year, its conferences and conventions. Beyond all of this, and perhaps most importantly, I love that birding itself is an exercise in delight, wonder, and gratitude. It teaches me to pay attention. And attention, I think, is at the very heart of what it means to be a person, what it means to extend and receive love. The more I fall in love with birds, the more I grow to love the whole of creation, standing in awe of the one who spun it all into being. Maybe birds aren't your jam. That's okay. You can pay loving attention to whatever it is that allures you. A soul-bending jazz lick, or the frost on your ski goggles, or the artful crackles in a warm sourdough boulet. Maybe it's children or grandchildren or rose bushes or nuclear physics or lacrosse or knitting or choir or finding the perfect skipping stone at every beach you encounter. This story is about birds, yes, but even more than that, it is about paying attention to grief as an avenue toward hope. The birds are secondary in a way. They are my spark, but they need not be yours. What they offer to us is a particular window into what it means to be human. That to be alive is to grieve. To keep being alive is to hope. To do either is to follow Wendell Berry's sage advice of continuing to be joyful, though we've considered all the facts. That is the heart of looking up. It was the poet Mary Oliver who wrote that much of the task of being human is to pay attention, be amazed, and share about it. Fascination and curiosity are spiritual practices. Early in my parenting, my mother, an amateur artist, taught me to invite my children to tell me about their artwork rather than asking them, "What is it?" or worse yet, guessing. Nothing deflates a child like an adult saying, "Oh, what a beautiful dog," when in fact, the child has drawn Santa Claus. The Psalms are a wonderful companion for learning this type of curiosity. We want prescription and command, do this and don't do that. We want a label beneath the drawing saying, "This is Santa Claus, not a dog." But the Psalms are metaphor and mystery, emotion and image, poetry and prayer. We can't kill them and pin them to a card like Eustace Clarence Scrubb's Beatles. They live and breathe and unsettle us. This is good. God intends it. In his poem, What I Wish You'd Heard, David Wright describes his angst as a college professor when he tells his students to choose research topics they can live with for 10 weeks. They chose the way we all do, the most for the least, plastic bottles marked soda. What he wants to do is go back in time and tell them a different story, choose something you would hate that will wake you up like a root beneath your sleeping bag when you pitched your tent at the most breathtaking spot, not the flattest. We think we need answers, clarity, ease, comfort, yet God is so often that root beneath our sleeping bag, waking us with an ache, inviting us to look up. Take a moment and look out a window. If you wait for a few moments, you're likely to see a bird, unless you're reading this on an airplane. What do you notice about it? Don't tell me it's just a pigeon or a sparrow or a crow. Don't discount a Canada goose. Watch it. Look at it. See it. There, you're a birder. You can go as far down that path as you like. Nearly everyone looks dorkishly dapper in a khaki vest. But really, birding is as straightforward as breathing. People can make it competitive or joyless, as they can most anything. But at its heart, birding is simply paying attention, holding still, and opening up to the wonder of natural spaces. It's cultivating mindfulness around creation. It's being present right where we are with what God has placed before us. Rowan Williams describes contemplative prayer as practicing awareness, a little bit like that of a birdwatcher. He continues, "The experienced birdwatcher, sitting still, poised, alert, not tense or fussy, knows that this is the kind of place where something extraordinary suddenly bursts into view." To me, birding is a spiritual practice. After all, as Williams describes, awareness is at the heart of all contemplative practice. I find that birding tethers me to vital rhythms in the tending of my soul, to prayer, and the study of scripture and the love of neighbor alongside the care of creation. It helps me uncouple from legalism and performance. I can tally the birds I see like I used to mark down the pages of scripture I read and studied, but unlike a book I can pull down from my shelf whenever I please, each bird that enters my gaze is here for a finite length of time, unpredictable and fleeting, a transient gift of delight. To bird is to learn how to wait in stillness. To bird is to learn how to see. Our church has a little prayer garden behind one of our worship spaces. Pebbled pavers winding their way around lavender plants and ornamental grasses and a stone cross. One year on Good Friday, I stood there watching the sunset, taking a moment in stillness before leading evening worship and, I'll just be honest, introverting after a long week of hectic ministry. In the golden beams of twilight, I watched a mourning dove alight on the cross, its pink feet curled over the edge, its feathers smooth and pale. I wondered what birds witnessed Jesus in the garden on the night he was betrayed. As I watched the dove, a symbol of peace and baptism and the power of the Holy Spirit, it suddenly hit me how little I really knew. There I was, one person among billions, standing in a California garden, dressed in a black robe and preparing to testify to wisdom from beyond the grave that had been handed down in ancient texts written in foreign tongues. I realized at that moment I had nothing of my own to offer. I could not possibly be clever enough or charismatic enough or competent enough to convince anyone of anything. Horror and then fear and then blessed relief watched over me. I was not up to the task because the task was not humanly possible. God would have to show up and teach all of us how to see. The older I get, the more I can see the wisdom of my elders. As a teenager, I already knew everything. Most teenagers do. The words of my parents and grandparents washed over me like water off a duck's back, constantly there but never soaking in. My maternal grandparents lived less than an hour away from the northern Wisconsin town in which my sisters and I were raised. Most weeks, we'd see them at least once. They'd bring us chocolate-frosted cake donuts from the green-roofed bakery just off the highway, and we'd eat them on stools around the breakfast table. Or else we'd drive over to their little lake house for dinner, winding down their gravel road with our mouths watering in readiness for the chicken and baked potatoes Grandpa cooked on his old charcoal grill. My grandfather strung feeders across their backyard, waging war with the gray squirrels intent on stealing the seeds he intended for his chickadees and goldfinches. "We had an oriole yesterday," he'd tell me. "I saw three robins." I'd respond, searching his shelves for Archie comics. "Cool." My grandfather was a man of few words and fewer pleasantries. He made Calvin Coolidge look chatty. But he did love animals and would talk more about them than anything else. I recognize now what he was saying to me in his bird reports. A kind of deeper, subtler way of speaking. A language unrecognizable until a person has suffered a great deal. He was telling me he loved me. This book is my way of doing the same. Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Courtney here with a special offer just for you. My new book is coming out in April. It's called Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. It's all about grief and sorrow and the ways that birds and birding can bring us to a place of hope. It's a book of faith. It's a book of humor. We would love to give you a 20% discount. You can use this code, IVPPOD20. That's IVPPOD20. That code will give you 20% off and free shipping anywhere in the US when you order from ivpress.com. Pick up your copy of Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief today. The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What is it on your soul? Yes, it does.